Androids and Assets returns. This time, they're joined by an unlikely ally. Star Wars expert, Justin. The trio continues on their epic battle across the galaxy as they dive deeper into Star Wars. What does it mean? Why is it so weird? And what's Disney going to do next with this super valuable IP? Will they show an ounce of courage and make something interesting? Will they just continue to slide further into reductive schlock? Find out more in this week's episode. Hello, I'm Steven.
And I'm Marshall. We have our special guest today, Justin, a friend of ours. He's the guy that we know that knows the most about Star Wars. We have proof of this. What's the name of the guy on Coruscant who opened a diner in episode 2?
I have no idea.
Okay, so you're going to just have to take our word for it. He knows a lot about Star Wars.
There's that great sequence where he's like the feat of CGI mastery where he pulls up his pants because he's got crack showing.
That's where Obi-Wan's talking about, like, he's got the dart, the trank dart.
Yeah. This is true.
Yeah, okay.
Well, this guy used to be a weapon smuggler, so he went to him as his, you know, source. Right. Hey, Dexter, I've got this dart. What do you think about it? Oh, well,
let's Obi-Wan! See. Yeah, what species is he?
You're the guy who knows the most about Star Wars that I know.
Oh, I see. I have no idea.
Star Wars expert!
I mean, there's more to being an expert than trivia.
That's true.
That's true, and we're going to find that out. We're discussing, as usual, themes within this movie, Star Wars. So I think we're being really broad and saying anything of the movies. Any of the seven movies, eight movies?
Eight movies.
Eight, anything in the eight movies we may touch on. So
plus the expanded universe.
We might go to the expanded universe. Some of us like it more than others.
I was raised on that shit. Put it in my veins.
Really? It's not canon anymore, though. I mean, it never was canon.
Who gives a fuck?
It doesn't exist.
It exists. God. All those books. My Timothy Zahn novels didn't disappear off the shelf when Disney bought it. It's all still there, man.
They didn't get any
better,
though.
You didn't go to the book burning? I thought for sure you were at the book burning.
Disney orders expanded universe novel book burning. No. Well, they kept Thrawn, so you just need to take your copy, your Timothy Zahn books, and just cut out all the parts with Mara Jade and the wild card and just all the non-Thrawn parts. You can keep the rest. You can keep the Thrawn parts.
And then just staple them together and you got yourself a...
Well, Disney will send you new pages.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah, you can
change program.
You just need to send them the proof of purchase.
Yeah. Yeah, take your Splinters of the Mind die and burn that shit, though. Like, because that's like the archetype. That's the first expanded universe kind of novel, right?
I mean, it's a lot funner than a lot of the later expanded universe, because the later expanded universe post Zahn, I guess, is just expanding upon the original three films, whereas Splinter of the Mind's Eye is, we're not going to get to make a sequel, so you can do whatever the hell you want. And so it's just a really shitty adventure that's mostly filled with hot and heavy sexual tension between Luke and Leia. Which is certainly something I'm into, so.
Which is a slightly less gross Shadows of the Empire.
As if that's possible.
Okay, so expanded universe aside. So one of the things we try and do is we're huge nerds, so we kind of talk about this, like, theoretical political economy of these speculative spaces, these imagined spaces. So
what's one of the things in your mind, Justin, that happens in the Star Wars films, movies, that you have noticed and maybe you think other people might not have picked up on?
All of it.
Wow.
That's bold.
Oh boy.
The whole thing. Let's parse these things a shot at a time, starting with the first one. I don't know. I think that, as we were discussing before, it's this whole narrative that, you know, after the prequels start coming out, we've got this horrible situation where George Lucas is corrupted, for lack of, to put it mildly, it's not how most people say it, but it corrupted people's childhoods by making these films that are just, you know, heavy with bizarre political lingo and racist caricatures, as if that's not the entire impetus for the entire franchise. I mean, he wanted to create something that was essentially a regurgitation of 30s adventure tropes, not strictly to the 30s, but as things had developed in the 30s and 40s. And so he just takes the entire media politics of the 30s and 40s and just completely recreates it, and we just pretend that none of that is problematic. As we were saying before with the fan people, just this, like, this whole colonial narrative of just the people on Tatooine, aside from the fact that we view, you know, we can kind of simplify it to, oh, Imperials are Nazis, blah, 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 blah. You've got this whole kind of microcosmic thing going on Tatooine, which reaches its logical conclusion with Sweet Baby Hayden committing a genocide, essentially, of a tribe of indigenous peoples. And that's just, you know, that's shocking, because that's late era George Lucas, as if that's not there in the first movie.
So you're talking about, obviously, in episode two, where Hayden massacres a tribe after they've tortured his mother, right?
Right. And this is his this is the beginning of his long descent. Well, this is not the beginning, but
not quite the beginning, but very near the beginning.
Yeah.
Well, being
a certainly when he starts crying.
It's okay to be a guy who carries a sword and kills people for a living, but when you just indiscriminately kill too many people, you just cross the line.
Well, and he did justify it by saying that they're not people, they're animals. And I do think that that's how the Sand People are often viewed, or at least sort of portrayed in the movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally unbelievable that, you know, he's just, you know, he's Darth Vader, so he's a genocidal maniac. And of course, Padme is shocked and appalled that he would behave in such a way.
And very forgiving.
Yes, well, yeah, and very accepting. That's arguably the moment when she falls in love with him, is after he's slaughtered this tribe of sand people. But, I mean, it's obviously not as blunt, but in the first film, the film, more or less, the kind of narrative of the film starts with all of this stuff about, you know, the sand people come out at night, Obi-Wan has to frighten them off by pretending that he's a dragon, I think. That sound has changed in every version of the film.
But that they're so superstitious or so primitive that him just pretending to make this sound is enough to terrify them.
Yeah, it's like they're literally savages. But I think it's easy to go down the path of saying, well, maybe we've got it wrong about the prequels, and Lucas is actually working through a lot of the baggage that was already there. Clearly that's not the case, because we have Jar Jar and the Trade Federation. But I've always thought that sequence in episode two is significant, because otherwise we would just kind of ignore that that's even an element of episode four. I'm trying to remember, some people don't appear in Return of the Jedi, do they?
No. I mean, maybe God knows what cyber monstrosities have been added in retroactively.
But they weren't on Tatooine, were they?
The sand people? No, they're not. Well,
they did go to Tatooine.
They're
briefly
in Jabba's palace, but I don't think there's any. Yeah. There's no sand people in Jabba's palace, as I recall.
Right.
No, but maybe you do see them briefly when they're out on the barge.
Oh yeah, there's some in the distance. Maybe,
after he did Anthas, the when he reimagined the movies.
Yeah, I think there's some CGI. Yeah.
Right, but even if, like, they're briefly in episode one during the kind of the Ben-Hur sequence, the pod race, when they're
where again they're just being animals walking into the course, or like, you know, yeah.
Or they're shooting. They've got snipers trying to take out the pods.
Yeah, just for fun.
Yeah, because they don't.
Yeah, so that's interesting. They're even outside of the kind of gangster fiefdom that runs Tatooine.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so racism is kind of a racism, adventurism, and Orientalism are all these kind of. This is a significant current in Star Wars.
There's some racism that people did seem to notice right off the bat, and pretty much everybody who watched Episode One went, "Oh wow, there were some parts in that that really should not have happened." The Trade Federation. They have.
But did you think that in 1999?
I think when I watched Episode One, I was like, why do they all have Asian accents and they're the bad guys?
Right.
I don't know that
I. You are slightly older than me, but you're a smarter youngster than I am. And I'm not saying that's so insidious that I wasn't able to recognize it, and then I just, you know, incorporated that into my, you know, burgeoning personality wholesale.
I don't think that I like articulated myself well at the time and of like, oh wow, that was super racist and shouldn't have been done. But it was something that I noticed, because in the original trilogies, there's so little accents that people have. Like everyone just speaks Galactic Basic, right?
Right.
With sort of like a classic Midwestern American accent.
The Atlantic accent.
Right.
And then in episode, like in the prequels, all of a sudden you have people speaking in their own sort of dialect or accents. So it's a bit jarring for one thing.
I guess the Empire all have British accents.
Oh, that's true.
Which is, you know, again, a very American thing to do. You know, the evil Empire is, of course, British against the American rebel forces. You know, there's a whole national myth just sort of neatly tied up there for you.
Yeah, I mean, unless you buy his whole, his later claim that the rebels are actually the Viet Cong, and the Empire is the U.S. But anyways, I think that it's not a crystal clear allegory in any sense. And if it was, it wouldn't be a phenomenon.
There's something said, like my partner, when we saw episode 7, she said, we're the Empire, like us, that's us. That's our civilization.
And the rebels are also conveniently, you know, good white people.
Yes. And the only one rebel who was an actual terrorist was who's the actor?
You're talking about Rogue Squadron?
Oh, this is Rogue Squadron. Yes.
Yeah, we're talking about Rogue Squadron has some very interesting actually, this is one of my pet go-tos, in that Rogue Squadron has this very confusing politics, in that like there's the good rebels who use airstrikes and attack them, strategic assassinations with snipers, very very US style tactics, and then there's the cowardly extremist rebels who attack convoys and wear black and are also surprisingly ethnic and live in a desert place. And so it's very, like, it's very, very charged that way. I saw that. And I was just horrified to see that, actually, that convoy battle scene where they were basically just saying, oh, that's not how you rebel. How you rebel is by having a sophisticated, modern army and fighting the enemies of your nation state. That's a true rebellion. So I think any sort of emancipatory thing that may have been bouncing around in there at some point is, real subverted at this point. It's all pretty far gone.
Are you talking about Rogue One?
Yeah, in Rogue One.
Yeah.
But who is the actor who plays the leader of the extremist rebels? Forrest Whitaker.
Yes,
Forrest Whitaker, right.
Yeah. Saw Gerrera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Possibly the worst way to add diversity to your cast.
Yeah, and I mean, what you were saying, Steve, is so interesting that it, as that film tried so desperately to be like a micro installment that literally, you know, closes at the very scene that opens the first film, which is... apparently that pitches a totally different portrait of the rebel forces, right? Where you just have, you know, a Jedi and then some kid who doesn't know anything that's going on. And they just use all of these guerrilla tactics. And then I guess you could argue at the end with the, X-Wing strike, that there's some level of organization there, but not to the degree that they suggest in Rogue One. Mm-hmm. So the idea that there was this like carefully executed, you know, military operation in order to get these plans, which then some buffoons kind of bounce around a bit and then, you know, just accidentally shoot it into the right hole. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as those movies go on, and maybe this is just the progression of time, but episode 4, yeah, it's very a haphazard sort of rebellion. But 5 and 6 seem much, much more like a civil war rather than the episode 4 sort of slapdash rebellion.
But it feels like even if you don't have the built-in, you know, for the EU, if you don't have both the expanded universe and the European Union, if you don't have the built, even without the knowledge of what's happening in between the films, it's clearly that there's a natural progression. You start to see there's actually some leadership that is represented by, you know, old people. Someone assumes there's some kind of defecting going on. So there's like a natural build, but there's always this like stress upon the retcon. One has to like work from pre-established norms at the end of kind of a narrative arc and fill in the back. And then it narratively doesn't make any sense. Obviously not what's important. But what I do think is important is that because the kind of insidious, subtle racial representations in the original trilogy are flown under the radar, and as you were saying, in the prequels, they're so kind of heavy-handed and right on the surface, I think it meant that for Disney, the only conversation they had about representation is they said, we just have to diversify the cast. And that's it. That's all we have to do, and the problem will be solved. And it doesn't matter, you know, and we'll diversify the cast, and then we'll just kind of whiten up the villains as much as we possibly can and make them British people again, which no one will have any issue with. And then there won't be any more of that. The baggage will all be just gone. It'll all just disappear on its own, which of course it doesn't. And then just, it's like this weird, like, plastic wrap, sanitized version of the thing, which I don't think works. And I think that's probably why Rogue One is so messy. Because you set it up and set them that this is the direction you're going to go. And then once you get into Rogue One, it's like, okay, so now what are the politics of this universe? We have no idea.
Well, the analogy, well, it's always very interesting, I think, because like the analogy, I think, that gets, again, heavy, super heavy-handed is the Empire's Nazis. And I think the analogy is very much of the Republic as like in the Weimar Republic.
Right.
So kind of this late stage, you know, liberal order thing. I think that gets erased, in all this is the notion that what Palpatine just was like super tricky and tricked them all into being racist and run by a faction of humanoid supremacists. Like, that's insane. Like at a certain point, all of these tensions, like these sort of racial tensions had to bubble under the surface and kind of get, there had to be a group of people who already believed this to kind of push it forward, right? To be given like the opportunity or support to push that agenda forward. And I think we're seeing this now in like Canada and the United States, in like the West, where all of these, you know, simmering white supremacist fascistoid tendencies, I mean, they've been there the whole time. It's just that like now they're kind of getting permission to come out. And so this notion that I think the Republic, yeah, the Republic clearly had all of these contradictions and problems also embedded in it, too.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, that's what's fascinating about the prequels is the kind of Bush-era narrative of kind of Bush-era Islamophobia. Really, Bush is now the
defender of Islam.
Yeah.
Well, so is Trump. So is Trump, according to Ben Salman. But,
right.
Ben Salman, Mohammed Ben Salman, the Crown Prince of
Saudi Arabia.
Who called him Islam's greatest friend.
As well. So when I watch episode 4, 5, and 6, I get a feeling that the Empire is old. Like that it's been around for a while.
Yeah. And the bureaucracy is kind of decayed. I mean, literally it's decayed, but he gets rid of the Senate.
Right. The Senate's a relic and he's finally gotten rid of it.
The Emperor's an old guy himself.
Right.
But then you find out it's like 18 years old.
At best, yeah. Like, oh wait, no, this is basically him. He co-opted the Republic, and we're not really seeing yet. Yeah, he changed the name to Empire, but this is the same bureaucracy, and these are people who just didn't have a backbone to resign when an evil guy took over. They were like, oh, well, Same boss, you know, new boss, same as the old boss.
Right.
And so that's always kind of been troubling for me, that when we talk about sort of how evil the Empire is, yeah, if it had been around for even 100 years and had had time to sort of consolidate itself and bring in new norms and such, then maybe I could see it. But saying that it's only like all of this happened within a single generation. Everyone forgot about the good guys and the Jedi. They just completely forgot that they existed. A hokey old myth.
Yeah. I mean, this is what it's like. I think this is precisely why, I think maybe not the only reason, but I think that this is one of the strong reasons why people rejected the prequels. Because it makes plain that the original films are about the crimes of late capitalist democracies. And it was a lot funner and easier to say, well, no, it's about pure storybook fascism is what it's actually about. And that's just simply not the case. I mean, the real question then is what, I think you're absolutely right about the kind of the erosion of the bureaucracy. They kind of just pick up the, and what's Leia's stepdad's name? The one good senator.
Bail Organa.
So we've got Bail Organa is Bob Corker in this scenario. No, I'm just kidding. But I think that this is what makes it really messy for the new films, because there's this desire from an economic point of view, from a pure, you know, butts and seats selling tickets point of view, to reject everything about the prequels. And I think the first thing that has to go is the politics. So what is the reimagined version then? Because it's not. I think you could say, well, we don't know anything about Snoke, but we're just rehearsing the same thing, where we have an opportunist who is just perverting a so-called republic, or the kind of ideals of a so-called republic. But I don't think that's what it is. I think they keep it purposely vague so that it can just go back to a kind of very easily understood black and white, good versus evil type thing.
Yeah. Well,
we'll see anyway.
I think a lot of those sort of stories around late stage capitalism being a bad thing, it's hard to make a lot of sales off of them.
Well, yeah, and this is what's so fantastic. I don't know. I really didn't intend to just be talking about how much I love the prequels, but this was so fantastic about those films is that. And what's so fantastic about the subsequent narrative of Lucas selling independent film company to the largest media monopoly in the world is that he makes these three films that are
hated,
that are extremely radical from that point of view, which nonetheless make a shitload of money and which allow him to then shuttle the whole thing off to a huge international conglomerate. And then go back to doing what? I don't know. He's just eating in his basement, I guess. I have no idea.
Well, is it, I don't know, is it radical or is it just, like, strongly liberal?
Oh, sure, yeah.
The best, you know, for me is a strong liberalism. Like you know, a Fabian approach, if you will.
You're right, it's not radical at all, but it's, what I find intriguing about it is that it's a very kind of aesthetically dry, strong liberalism. There's basically nothing in those films to make it palatable to an audience at all. I mean, certainly it's like you can go see any Hollywood movie and you could describe it as having a strong liberalism. But sometimes it feels like in those films they are purposely arcane to alienate the audience.
Yes, I would say that's true. I mean, at a certain point, Lucas is just amusing himself, I think. But, I mean,
yeah.
not that that's really a productive way to go about it. I mean, the auteur question is much of where we get the most frustrating things in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm never inclined, but obviously we've been doing it this entire time, but I'm usually not inclined to do, you know, to get into authorial intent, especially when it comes to film, which is, you know, possibly the most collaborative medium there is. But it is interesting that you see I mean, the entire way that franchise is understood is around the aegis of auteurism, right? Yeah. So it's like he occasionally pops his head back up and says, I would never get back involved because Disney would want me to do what they wanted to do and they would corrupt my vision. And then you have these stories that come out every few weeks that, you know, Kathleen Kennedy has fired someone from directing something because their, you know, visions didn't match up or whatever. Yeah. So I think it is still like very tightly controlled in a very fascistic sense. But I just don't know if it's working.
Well, Disney himself harbored deep fascist-like sympathies.
Oh, sure.
In his life.
Yeah. Constant labor strikes, not giving credit to any of his animators. Mm-hmm. So it's a great long tradition. Great.
To which Star Wars is the inheritor. Is there anything else you want to talk about, like a little bit of the racism? Because one thing you talk about in this light of adventurism, like it's about like a young white man gets a laser sword and goes off and finds interesting things to do and have sex with. That's a big part of your, as I understand it, that's a big part of your lens through which you see Star Wars as happening.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's essentially Gunga Din, right?
Yeah.
Which is not, you know, that's not anything novel, and Lucas has basically said that, but it's very steeped in this idea of, I don't think it's even the idea of kind of a World War II ideology of, you know, sign up and do the right thing and defend your way of life. I think it's much more, you know, go out and experience the colonies until you, until dad dies and you inherit the estate is much more what it is. And then obviously that's complicated as the films go on because Teddy's estate is not what we expected it to be. But I don't know. I don't know what else there is to say about adventurism, really, because our entire conversation about Orientalism is really the
backdrop for that.
Yeah, that's really what it's picking up. You know, it's like you've got essentially it's for lack of a better description, it's either, you know, an adventure to the Far East or to darkest Africa. Like that's exactly what that first film is.
Yeah, I mean, even in some ways, when we first meet Luke, he's whining that his friends have all gone off to the academy, and he just wants to go to the academy and
to fight for the Empire.
Yeah, like he wants to become a soldier for the Empire.
Yeah,
and that's really his only motivation in it, and he doesn't end up fighting against the Empire because because of how evil they are and that he's a good person. It's that they killed his foster parents and he wants revenge.
Yeah. A young man becomes radicalized and goes off to fight with an armed militia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. And I've never heard that story before.
Encounters discrimination that he hadn't perceived before. Yeah. I mean, that's what's so interesting, that he doesn't, that he's not, to place him on a planet where, you know, clearly they're, I mean, I was going to say they're not, maybe they are a little destitute, but they seem to have as much blue milk and cabbage soup as they want.
I think there's some extent to which he's sort of like a middle peasant. Like they are human settlers in they're frontier human settlers in a human supremacist settler society. Right. So they are, you know, so.
Which,
so
I mean, are, I understand.
In that sense, siloed.
I understand that for sure. But they also talk about Tatooine being so far on the rim of the galaxy that the Hutts control it, and they don't really have any Imperial support there. So even if he is a colonialist sort of settler, it's not as though there's a supply train that comes in and is like, yep, here's your guys' blue milk to keep you going for another year.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it's more in the tradition of I think that the inheritance from Westerns is obviously, as you, I think you're saying, Steve, the what to look at. It's not as if, I think that it only becomes convenient in Return of the Jedi to do a kind of gangster movie pastiche because he had, you know, gotten bored. But, you know, without the Hutts in that first one until it was added later, one assumes that any kind of, you know, quasi-government is likely just run by a bad man, you know, like an outlaw, essentially.
Right.
Which I think is probably the intention of Java originally, because in the original sequence, that one that they added back or whatever in the special edition, he's just like a fat guy dressed in furs, right?
True.
And he only becomes a gangster slug later, but anyway.
But there's something I want to get at here, though, a little bit, which is, like, there's a couple things, and this is made, I think, really apparent in the reboot, and it's that you have Luke is actually on a frontier, on a western setting, and then it actually kind of weirdly turns on its head, and particularly, this is where the use of the term rebel is actually, I think, very telling, in the sense it almost has a sort of antebellum sort of connotation, almost, like in the sense that there's a rebellion against the Empire. I think there is maybe some south-north dynamics that come in, and which is why, like, one of the things they did is they really cleaned all of that out. Like, it's called the Resistance now, right? Like, there's really an effort to clean out a lot of anything that could be potentially interpreted as a connotation to the south.
Yeah, I hadn't really considered that before. I guess the only trouble I would have with that reading is that he has no geographic or cultural allegiance, right? Like, it's very much like, I'm going to get out of here just because that's what I want to do, and there's nothing for me here.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he just kind of falls in with people. Yeah. But, I mean, that would be interesting if he was...
Well, I'm making a lot out of this sense that it's a pastoral fringe society, because even Alderaan is quite pastoral. It's a pastoral fringe society. It's a pastoral society fighting against an urbanized industrialist society.
Right. Yeah.
I'm building a lot on that, which is very tenuous, I acknowledge.
Yeah, and I don't know that it was the pastoral societies that were fighting back, right? It wasn't Tatooine that was the rebellion. It was one guy on two guys on Tatooine.
I mean, Biggs.
I was thinking him and Obi-Wan, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, Biggs is in there, too.
But Biggs was in the Academy.
Yeah.
And realized how bad...
He defected.
He defected when he saw just how bad the Empire actually was.
TIE fighters suck.
This is what's so interesting about Rogue One, is that all of that stuff is on the periphery, right? So you've got Biggs, which isn't even, again, not in the film until much later when it was re-edited. But you've got Biggs, who's like... That's a lot, you know, there's an easier lineage to follow there. He goes to the Academy. He falls in with the underground. Again, he's, you know, radicalized in a more traditional sense that we can understand, and then recruits Luke. But then that gets cut out. So you've got this kid who's literally just... I mean, the thing that we're not talking about is that he falls in with an arcane religion.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's hugely important.
Oh, right. The Jedi. I mean, I guess for me that was probably most interesting about Rogue One. I get the notion of, again, from just a narrative standpoint, of saying, well, we're going to just leave them out of this so that we're not just making a series of films where, you know, the Jedi just becomes a showcase for people jumping around and flying through the air. But this idea that you've got this kind of, like, this specter of a collapsed religion, which was... the very kind of, like, lifeblood of the Republic.
Yep.
I mean, I'll be interested to see how that plays out in The Last Jedi, because I feel like the marketing of it has served to suggest that Luke has some hesitation and regrets about all of these things we've been talking about. But I don't see how that would fit into their larger political project. Unless he comes around at the end, I guess.
Yeah. Comes around and joins the Resistance again?
Well, comes around and, you know, if he is kind of debating whether or not his very limited worldview of good versus evil has any legitimacy at all, then ultimately he decides that it does have some legitimacy, which is, I'm sure, what will happen.
Yeah. There is sort of an interesting dynamic between him and his sister in that he seems to have... He came on to join the rebellion for revenge and then sort of became a leader and then left and now feels some regret. Whereas Leia seems to have been well indoctrinated from a very young age and is a serious true believer.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, leading the rebellion all throughout that time. We don't know what she did with the New Republic, but as soon as it became available... She was a leader again in the Resistance against the First Order.
Well, we don't know what she did with the New Republic, aside from the fact that she's a bad mom.
Yes, she is. She is a bad mom.
What a waste.
There are a lot of questions for me that were raised in The Force Awakens by the existence of the Resistance.
Right.
Because there's the New Republic, and then it faces an uprising. It faces its own rebellion. And rather than marshaling and bringing together its army to fight against the rebellion, it outsources that to a resistance group that is not answerable to the Republic. And they're like, we need a well-regulated militia, and they'll handle this for us.
This is very much actually the story of how these things break down, though. Because, like, what you end up with is you get some sort of transitional form. Like, this is what happened in the Russian Revolution, right? You get the provisional government, like, the monarchy breaks down, and then you get, okay, we're a republic, and this is the old power structure. And then the monarchist loyalist generals say, fuck no, we're our own bosses now. And then you have the revolutionary factions still also fighting, because they are also not recognized by the new compromise government. And so these things always break down into a three or more way struggle in the early phases. And very quickly, through Games of Thrones type maneuverings, a couple of those get eliminated pretty quick.
But I don't think the Resistance is fighting against the New Republic.
But I think if you look at Syria right now, like, that's very much how things shake down. Like, you have like the Free Syrian Army will fight the Islamic State, but they'll also work together to rout the government.
Right, but the government has a stake in it.
Yeah.
And in this one, the New Republic doesn't seem to have its own military force.
Yeah, not
it's purely political, and it's like, yeah, we're just going to govern, but we don't have a standing army, and we don't have any sort of, like, military force backing us up. And that's one of the major traditional forms of enforcing
state power.
State power is by having a large military that you can wield like a club whenever you need to. And they seem to have, in this new iteration, said, you know, the Republic, we don't do the fighting thing. We'll just outsource that to an arm's length group led by General Leia Organa, and we'll label it the Resistance. And we'll let these two arm's length groups duke it out, and we'll just govern whoever wins?
And suffer heavy losses. Yeah, that's interesting. So they don't have a military because of ideological purity?
I have no idea.
The thing is, it's a movie.
Yeah, but why?
The whole pretext of this thing falls apart.
I mean, I just don't know why it would have been a problem to have said, yeah, this is the Republic Army instead of the Resistance. Like, why did they make that choice?
Because it would alienate the fans and devalue its capacity as, like, it still has to be scrappy rebels fighting a big fascistoid military machine. But you also can't ignore the narrative, which is why they conveniently just were like, and that's not a thing anymore. All these expanded universe planets, they died!
But I mean, it's scrubbing the legacy of the prequels. Mm-hmm. If you do go that route, then it's not only that you need to have this, you know, pure rebels versus some kind of fascistoid, well-organized force, whatever, the First Order. I keep forgetting that they're not the Empire. It's that if you build in this kind of, in what is apparently a saga, if you build in this kind of cyclical worldview into the politics of the thing, then people are going to get turned off. Because suddenly we're talking about trade disputes again.
lengthy scrolls explaining the geopolitics of...
Yeah, I wish.
I think they needed a little more exposition to explain just why Naboo was being blockaded. What did they produce on Naboo that they were being blockaded?
Yeah, who knows? And what did they do to deserve the blockade, aside from having an outspoken child queen?
Right. I also think that they could have done with a lot more scenes of the trade tribunals of the Republic. Like a group of 25 people, various alien races, debating whether Naboo should or should not have to pay the fines that the Trade Federation has said that they should...
Lumber tariffs from Biffs will now be heard. Yeah. Now, it was received that on March 23rd of the last intergalactic year, the planet of Biffs placed tariffs upon... Yeah, there should be more of that.
I agree. You could make 6 or 7 movies easily.
This is the movie I would watch. Yeah. Disney.
They don't do any of that, but there is. I mean, what's that? In episode 2, there is a meeting of kind of the heads of the Trade Federation, and they're all kind of crappy avatars of like 50s monster movies. There's like a green brain in a jar or something.
Yeah.
And a wolf man, and they're all meeting with literally Hammer Horror Christopher Lee.
Separatists. Yeah, the separatists.
Separatists.
And the separatists are all aliens. So again, you see that racialization shaking out.
Maybe they're a confederacy. Maybe that's what the blockade's about. Maybe there's some kind of slave trade going on that we're not given. We're not privy to the actual narrative.
We know there's slavery in the Star Wars galaxy.
The planet that they meet on are the ones producing droids.
Geonosis.
This is that whole conspiracy theory that it's the whole saga is about droid enslavement.
Yeah. Well, that's something we've talked about. Well, thank you, Justin, for taking the time to talk with us. We really appreciate having you on. Appreciate your Star Wars expertise.
Right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Marshall, any thoughts?
No, stick around for more of Star Wars Month. We're really excited to go out and see The Last Jedi. We're seeing it, as soon as we possibly can see it. And then we'll record something about what we thought.
Yeah, so we'll be...
You don't work for the LA Times, obviously.
No, I don't work for the LA Times, you're right.
I say, we'll see it as soon as we can, but I won't stand in line and I won't see it in 3D and I won't go out of the house. So,
wow.
You'll be hearing from us sometime in mid-June.
Music this week is from Scandroid.